When my husband and I were first married, we were introduced to Dave Ramsey's method for eliminating debt. Maybe you're familiar with it. At the risk of oversimplifying a lot, he advises essentially that you would list out your debts from smallest to largest and then start to pay them off in that order as well, smallest to largest. It really struck me because as someone who has an undergraduate degree in finance, that is not what I would have expected. I would have expected someone to advise that you pay off the debt with the highest interest rate first. But his whole method is based on psychology, that it is important for people to see wins in order to stay motivated on a journey. So in essence, his methodology tries to create and harness momentum. Momentum can be defined as increasing forward motion. Think of like a snowball rolling down a hill. Psychologically speaking, momentum is important and it shows up in our daily lives in a myriad of ways. It shows up in sports, as sports teams try to get something going, start a winning streak. And it shows up in weight loss. It's so hard to get started, but once the weight starts coming off, it's pretty easy to keep it going. And it works in reverse. Have a couple bad eating days or no gym days, and all of a sudden that can become the new norm to the point where you feel like there's absolutely nothing you can do to stem the tide. We have seen and we continue to see that momentum has played a role in the Israelites' conquest of the Promised Land. And it is a factor in our faith as well. This week's passage concludes the distribution of the Promised Land to the Israelites. So my plan for today is for us to work our way through the text. But then I want to spend some time talking with you about some ways the conquest of the Promised Land has challenged my faith personally. Since this week concludes the distribution of the Promised Land, let's start by quickly reviewing what we have seen thus far. As the Israelites approached the Promised Land towards the end of the book of Numbers, we saw that they conquered some kings east of the Jordan and took possession of their land. At that point, 2.5 tribes, what we refer to as the eastern tribes, asked for and were granted an inheritance outside of the Promised Land before everyone crossed into Israel. The Israelites then crossed the Jordan, and God gave them a miraculous victory at Jericho, followed by a little blip, and then another victory at Ai, and we saw that they were starting to get some momentum. In week 5, we read about a series of battles, the southern campaign followed by the northern campaign, and those battles brought most of the land of Canaan under Israelite control. And at the beginning of last week's passage, it seems that the Israelites had started to lose a little bit of their momentum. So at that point, God himself intervened to encourage the people on. A great deal of the land remained to be possessed, so he had Joshua distribute the unconquered lands as a means of spurring the people on. They would be fighting for their own inheritance. So Joshua allocated land to Caleb, the tribe of Judah, and the tribes of Joseph. And we saw that it worked. They were successful in settling more of the land. And as this week's passage opens, it seems that the Israelites once again have started to lose a bit of momentum. Let's start reading in Joshua chapter 18, starting in verse 1. The entire Israelite community assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The land had been subdued before them, but 7 tribes among the Israelites were left who had not divided up their inheritance. So Joshua asked the Israelites, "How long will you delay going out to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, gave you?" The first thing we're told this week is that the community assembled at Shiloh and set up a tent of meeting there. Shiloh is about 20 miles north of Jerusalem, within the tribal allotment of the tribe of Ephraim. It is very centrally located within Israel. And although we are not told so, we can assume that they did this because of what was commanded back in Deuteronomy at God's command, that this time and this place would be selected. The tabernacle had been in Gilgal, during the conquest of the Promised Land. And at this point, it was moved to Shiloh, where it would remain for hundreds of years. With this selection, Shiloh became the religious center of the nation of Israel. Anyone who wanted or needed to offer a sacrifice to the Lord would have to travel to Shiloh to do so. And all of the Jewish males would have went 3 times a year, and they would have brought their families usually too, to Shiloh to celebrate the festivals of the Lord. The fact that God chose Shiloh and had the tabernacle placed here, or moved here, indicates to us that the conquest of the Promised Land was drawing to a close. And we're more or less told that at the end of verse 1. The land had been subdued before them. The land was more or less under Israelite control. But apparently, the 7 remaining tribes were delaying going to take possession. They had lost some momentum. Last week, God encouraged the people on. But this week, it was Joshua who encouraged the people on. And he didn't just chastise them. He gives them something practical that they can do. He laid out the process by which they would continue to divide up the land. And I think his process was really quite brilliant. It avoided a lot of potential problems that could have happened. First, Joshua had the tribes themselves select the representatives. He didn't select the representatives for them. This would avoid them coming back later being like, well, I didn't really want that guy to pick my inheritance. I didn't want him to represent me. He also had each tribe send 3 representatives, not 1. So if there was any problems, all the blame wouldn't fall onto one person. This group of 21 men were sent to survey the land, and they wrote a description of it, and before anyone received their section, they divided it up into 7 sections. This makes me think of like what parents do when they have 1 cookie and 2 kids. They have 1 kid split the cookie and the other kid gets to pick their half. And the idea there is that the one that is splitting the cookie will be very, very careful to make that exactly even. So the tribes here didn't know what section they were going to get. And each section of land was going to have its pros and its cons. So essentially they are incentivized to try to make it as even as possible because they do not know which section they are going to receive. Finally, Joshua points out over and over again that the section each tribe would receive would be chosen by lot. Essentially, he is saying, God is going to give you your selected piece of property, not me. When the men return, lots are cast, and the first lot came up for the tribe of Benjamin. They received their section. Did you notice that counted within the cities that Benjamin received were most of the Gibeonites' cities that they freely gave up as part of their treaty with Israel? The second lot came up for Simeon. Simeon's allotment was quite a bit different from the other tribes' allotments. When we look at the allotments for the other tribes, it usually calls out a border and then a number of cities. For Simeon, it is just a number of cities, and they are all within the tribal allotment of the tribe of Judah. It turns out that the allocation of Simeon's land was the fulfillment of the prophecy made by the patriarch Jacob at the end of Genesis. He said that of both Levi and Simeon, that they would be scattered throughout Israel. Look, they're scattered. And the tribe of Levi would be scattered in much the same way, except their cities, they would receive cities, and they would be throughout all of Israel. And I think this shows us something good about prophecy, that it is always going to end up being true, but it's almost impossible to tell how until after the fact. Next, the lot came up for Zebulun, then Issachar, then Asher, then Naphtali, and finally Dan. When we look at Dan's inheritance, it was also quite a bit unique. They received 1 section of land, and then we're told that when it started to fall out of their control, they actually just went and conquered a different section and settled there. Finally, after all the tribes received their inheritance, the Israelites gave Joshua an inheritance. The Lord commanded that Joshua be given the city of Timnath-Serah, which apparently he had asked for. Timnath-serah was in the hill country of Ephraim. Now, this makes total sense because Joshua was of the tribe of Ephraim. So, of course, he's going to select a city within his tribe's allotment. And this city was also very close to Shiloh, so it would have made it very easy for him to get to the tabernacle. As chapter 19 draws to a close, we are told that they finished dividing up the land amongst the tribes. And as chapter 20 opens, God tells the Israelites to select and establish cities of refuge. Let's start reading in Joshua 20, starting in verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, "Tell the Israelites, select your cities of refuge as I instructed you through Moses, so that a person who kills someone unintentionally or accidentally may flee there. These will be your refuge from the avenger of blood." I bet this section seemed really weird to most of you, and maybe even a bit vigilante. So let me try to explain. The ancient Israelites were a tribal society. There are still tribal societies in the world today, and they function quite a bit differently than what we are used to here in the United States. Here in the U.S., our government is responsible for enforcing our laws. So when someone is murdered here, the police will investigate. They'll figure out who they think committed the crime. There will be a trial, and then a sentence will be pronounced based on the outcome of that trial. Essentially, the government is responsible for protecting and enforcing our laws. In tribal societies, this works quite a bit differently. The tribe itself is responsible for protecting its members. According to God's law, murder carried the death penalty. So instead of a police force investigating and carrying out justice, if someone was murdered in ancient Israel under this tribal society, it was the responsibility of the avenger of blood, usually the closest male relative of the victim, to ensure that justice was carried out. The avenger of blood had the responsibility, the duty, of putting the murderer to death. The cities of refuge had served a very specific purpose. If anyone accidentally killed someone, they could flee to a city of refuge. And as you can see, the cities of refuge were positioned throughout the land. When someone arrived at a city of refuge, the elders of that city would hear their case, do a thorough examination, and make a determination. If they determined that the person was not guilty of murder, they had the responsibility of protecting the manslayer from the avenger of blood, as long as they stayed in the city of refuge. However, if they found out that the person was actually a murderer, they were to turn him or her over to the avenger of blood so that they would be put to death. All bloodshed is serious, but murder is very serious. And not all killing is murder. Accidentally killing someone, manslaughter, is not murder. Death as a result of war is also not murder. And furthermore, since God commanded the death penalty, putting someone to death for the crimes they committed is also not murder. I realize that it's hard for us to see or to understand, but the Bible indicates that murder affects the land itself. Think back to Genesis chapter 4, when Cain murdered his brother Abel because he was jealous of him. When God confronted Cain, he said to him, "What have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." In Numbers, God said, "Do not defile the land where you live, for bloodshed defiles the land. And there can be no atonement for the land because of the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of the person who shed it. Do not make the land unclean where you live and where I dwell, for I, the Lord, reside among you." And in Leviticus, God warned, "If you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it has vomited out the nations that were before you." God absolutely cares about individual justice. He does not want people put to death wrongly. And he also seems to care about minimizing the effect of murder to the land itself. The cities of refuge were key to ensuring both of these things, individual justice and minimizing the effect to the land. So many details about the cities of refuge should help us notice that they point to the person and work of Christ. Christ is referred to as our refuge. We are told to flee to him. That's pretty straightforward. But if we missed it, all the details about the death of the high priest should draw our attention because it seems so bizarre. Why did they have to stay in the cities of refuge until the death of the high priest? It doesn't actually seem all that fair. Like, what if the high priest died the next day? Or what if it was 50 years? What is so special about the death of the high priest? The book of Hebrews refers to Jesus Christ as our ultimate high priest. And we know that his atoning sacrifice is what makes anyone who trusts in that sacrifice right with God forever. Before Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, God's people had to continually offer sacrifices until Christ would offer himself once and for all. It seems that the cities of refuge help us understand better what Christ would ultimately do for humanity. After the death of the high priest, the one who had fled to a city of refuge was free to go home. After Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, all who flee to him for refuge are free to go home to the presence of God. Chapter 20 was dedicated to the cities of refuge. And then when we move on to chapter 21, we see the Levites requesting their cities. Let's start reading in Joshua 21, verse 1. The Levite family heads approached the priest Eleazar, Joshua son of Nun, and the family heads of the Israelite tribes. At Shiloh, in the land of Canaan, they told them, "The Lord commanded through Moses that we be given cities to live in, with their pasture lands for our livestock." So the Israelites, by the Lord's command, gave the Levites these cities with their pasture lands from their inheritance. The Levites received cities from each of the tribes. And as we noted earlier, they were scattered throughout Israel. Six of the 48 cities that they received were the cities of refuge that we just talked about. So they would have been the ones making sure that anyone who fled to a city of refuge was eligible to actually stay there. After the Levites received their cities, chapter 21 wraps up with what I think is a very bold declaration. Starting in verse 43. "So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side according to all he had sworn to their ancestors. None of their enemies were able to stand against them, for the Lord handed over all their enemies to them. None of the good promises the Lord made to the house of Israel failed. Everything was fulfilled." This passage makes it abundantly clear that God did everything he promised to do. So now, it stood with the people to be obedient and to do their part. So now that we've worked our way through the passage and should have a pretty good understanding of the text itself, I want to step away as a teacher of the word, and I want to talk to you as a fellow student of the word. These things are different. As a teacher of the word, I'm most concerned with the text being understood correctly, and I feel a real burden to not say anything that could even be slightly off. But as a fellow student of the word, I get to let God speak to me personally and individually. I get to notice things and think about them, wrestle with them, lay out a hypothesis and test it, maybe change my mind later. One of my favorite things about Bible study is that I get to be a student of the word too, and I love this process. The Israelites' conquest of the Promised Land has very profoundly impacted me personally as a student of the word. So before we close today, I want to share with you three things that I have been thinking about and wrestling with. The first thing I have been wrestling with is what the conquest of the Promised Land shows us about the interplay between God and his people. When we studied in the book of Numbers, we wrestled a bit with what to make of the request of the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. The fact that they requested land outside of the Promised Land, and God gave it to them. We aren't told what God thought about that. We weren't told that he was displeased with their request. So we got to sort of wrestle, like, was that okay? Or was it maybe not God's best for them? The fact that God gave the eastern tribes what they asked for suggests to me that there is indeed an interplay between God and his people. On the one hand, this encourages me very much to just ask God for what I want. But then it also challenges me to maybe be a little more careful with my requests. Because I might ask for something and God might give it to me because he loves me and I asked for it when he was prepared to give me something better. When we look at the allocation of the Promised Land, we see that it was not a one-size-fits-all allocation. God did not follow the same process for each person or tribe. And so I think it shows us a little bit of nuance, perhaps acceptable nuance. Some asked for things. Some were told what they would receive. Some received one thing and then went off and took something else. Maybe that is how things work spiritually as well. Maybe we receive what we come right out and ask for. Maybe we receive some things that we didn't ask for directly. Maybe God has one plan for us, but when we are frustrated and not making progress and go and take something else, he lets us. This makes me wonder if things are not much more open than I might have originally thought. I'm very challenged by this. The second way in which the Israelites' conquest of the Promised Land has challenged me personally is regarding our responsibility in our inheritance. The Israelites' inheritance came inherently with responsibilities. It took me a ridiculously long amount of time to notice that and let it sink in. And I think that might be because my idea of an inheritance is really basic. Like someone dies and they give someone money and then they're able to go do with that whatever they want. But that is not how the Israelites' inheritance worked. The tribe of Levi received as their inheritance the priesthood. So they were responsible for the tabernacle and proper worship. They received cities, and they would serve as the elders in those cities. Six of those were the cities of refuge. So they would hear murder trials and make sure justice was served. The rest of the tribes had the responsibility of fighting for the land, keeping it. When they had it, building it out. Defending it. The fact that the Israelites' inheritance came with responsibilities has me wondering what responsibilities we have in our inheritance in Christ. God has promised us many things. He's promised us victory, peace, rest, and abundant life. Do we have to fight for those things? Do we have to keep them, build them out, defend them? Have you thought about it like that? Finally, I want to wrap up today by sharing my biggest epiphany of late, which comes right from the conquest of the Promised Land, and it has to do with momentum. Every time we write and teach a study, I'm convinced that I'm the one who learns the most. But there is a difference between learning like, oh, hey, yeah, I didn't recognize that. That's interesting. And learning like something very profoundly impacting how you live your daily life. Because of how long I've walked with the Lord, I now know how to spot when a breakthrough is happening coming for me personally. It is coming right after I am frustrated, possibly despairing over something. So when we were thick in the writing of the study, and I found myself despairing. I knew, or probably more accurately, I hoped that a breakthrough was, that something big was coming for me. So here was my issue. We saw over and over again last week that the Israelites did not drive out the Canaanites. God gave them the land, and they did not completely take it. And God warned them that if they didn't take it, it was going to cause problems for them in the future. At the same time, God told them that he was not going to drive out the Canaanites all at one time. He was going to do it little by little. Ladies, I found that so discouraging. I am not a little by little kind of lady. I'm the type that would stay up all night in college to write a paper just to turn it in and crash. And I'm ashamed to say that in the 20 plus years post college, I have not improved much. I do everything like this. I push really hard and then I let up. I do this Herculean effort to get to meet a deadline, and then I binge watch a Netflix series. So I found this more than a little bit disheartening. Lord, you gave something and the Israelites couldn't take it. You say you're going to give little by little, and I'm not a little by little kind of lady. What hope do I have? And that desperation brought up a lot of self-examination. Like, maybe this is a really terrible process I follow. Is it really not possible for me to work differently? I remember from one of our past studies having all day to write a teaching, and I needed that day just to sit down and have nothing. All of the time in the world is worthless if you don't have an idea. And this reminded me of what we've seen with God in the conquest of the Promised Land. God had to give, and the people had to take. All this wrestling, and then it hit me. And it's embarrassingly simple. How we have victory, little by little, is to just keep showing up. To keep directing our attention to the task before us, daily, weekly, monthly, annually. If we do this, we will not lose momentum, we will gain it. If the Israelites had a mechanism, actually they did, they gathered 3 times a year in Shiloh. If they would have used that mechanism to say, hey, so how's it going? How's the conquest of the province? Where can we make a little progress? Should we go attack that city over there? They would have been successful because God gave it to them. So I started trying to do this in my daily life, to just start showing up. I've got 15 minutes. How can I push this ahead? How can I push this ahead? And I have been absolutely shocked at how well it works. And I'm only talking about like really not spiritual things. So I cannot wait to see how this, in my endeavors in Sabbath or whatever, how God uses this. Those of you who have done Bible study with us for a while, you know how big I am on God's appointed times, on the Sabbath and his festivals. And that is because God has been very real and active in my life as I have paused to direct my attention to him and his priorities. Much of life, especially nowadays, is attention management. Everything is constantly vying for our attention. So if we want what God is giving us, we have to find a way to direct our attention to God and these things frequently, daily, so that as he gives, we are in a position where we can take. As you can see, I've been very challenged and stretched by letting God speak to me personally through the book of Joshua. And I want to encourage all of you to press into this process as well. We have just a couple of weeks of study left. Where has God been drawing your attention? What has He been inviting you to wrestle with?